You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Caroline Hyde and Ed Ludlow.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Coming up, Tesla gets a tentative approval for its driving system in China. Details ahead.
Plus, Paramount expected to oust its CEO ahead of earnings tonight. We'll bring you the latest.
And SoFi shares, they drop after Q2 guidance disappoints. We're going to discuss all of it with the CEO, Anthony Noto. But first, let's check in on these markets because, look, we're cautiously up on the NASDAQ at the moment, up 0.3%. We've got a big week. You've got the Fed. You've got the all-important claims. We've got jobs data on Friday. We're seeing the NASDAQ still managing to be up about 48 points. Now, we're seeing a 10-year yield actually diving back some 4 or 5 basis points. Let's call it ahead of the all-important Federal Reserve. And indeed, just where we see this economy, this interest rate environment going, notably a lot capturing the attention on the macro perspective and what's happening in Japan at the moment. Look, we've got a holiday period that means some of the trading is going to be more muted in Japan, but the yen, some big volatility over the course of the weekend. Monday trading, we're down a percentage point on the dollar versus the yen. The yen goes higher. Was it Japanese BOJ intervention? So far, they remain mum on the subject. We look forward to what's happening in terms of another dollar-related asset. This one, Bitcoin, down versus the US dollar by about 1.25%. Look, we're still seeing perhaps a little bit of a risk-off feel to Bitcoin more generally, and ETF flows were 62,859. What are you looking at on the micro, though, Ed?
Well, Tesla, and Tesla is a big, almost surprise story this Monday. The stock up 12.4%. It's just a few tenths of a percent away from its biggest jump since January of 2022. Very similar gains to what we saw April 24th, the day after earnings. The story, prelim or tentative approval for full self-driving in China. That's according to a Bloomberg source. Two subsets of that, a partnership with Baidu on the in-car mapping specifically for the China market, and then also an agreement over data and privacy, or terms on data and privacy, that will allow it to move forward with FSD. Big reaction in the market. Elon Musk himself went to China over the weekend, met with Premier Li Qiang, which was itself a surprise 7 days after he bailed on India, and there's a lot to unpick in this one, but it's a big move higher on the Tesla stock. Caro.
Yeah, we got to dig in with none other than Craig Trudell, Bloomberg, of course, all over this story throughout the day and indeed, well, previous night. It was a surprise and it looks as though the meeting bore fruit. What exactly does this mean for the overall robo-taxi, autonomous vehicle kind of future that Elon paints?
Yeah, we have to really separate out robo-taxi and what Tesla calls full self-driving, because that that nomenclature has been a misnomer. It is a driver assistance system. When you activate it, you're in control of the vehicle. You're responsible for supervising it. And if you do get into a crash, Tesla has shown a tendency to turn around and blame you, the driver. And so there's a big difference between this system Tesla calls FSD, and this robo-taxi that Musk has managed to get Wall Street excited about, despite the fact that he's been talking about it as a concept now, you know, since 2016 at least. But this is a big development in the sense that FSD, for all its shortcomings and the progress that still needs to be made for it to be, more widely used and accepted, it is bringing in incremental revenue, but only in certain markets. In the U.S., this is something that Tesla charges $8,000 for, or a $99 a month subscription. If it can, you know, make arrangements to get incremental revenue out of its customers in China, it could boost its business there at a time it could sorely use a lift.
Craig, as best I can tell, you've been logged on your Bloomberg terminal for like 27 hours straight, coordinating our teams in China, the US, in Europe. Just explain the chronology of what happened. There were multiple stages to arrive at what is a tentative approval for FSD.
Yeah, I mean, we heard rumblings that Musk was maybe going to make this trip. And, you know, lo and behold, Sunday my time here in London, we wake up to this idea that, yes, Musk has landed. This was a surprise in the sense that Tesla, you know, doesn't even have a presence at this week's Beijing Auto Show. It's a show that got underway last week. But it certainly was, you know, a timely visit in the sense that there are a lot of, government officials in town for the show. You know, the auto industry has absolutely been a bright spot for the Chinese economy. And, you know, China's relationship with Tesla has been really positive. This is, a success story, even with the challenges that this company has had lately with sort of continuing its momentum in China.
Market share being eroded to none other than BYD, the local competitor. Remind us of the deals that have had to be done with Chinese players, though, ultimately, to be able to get the granting.
Yeah, the key one that Ed flagged is with Baidu. And I think this is really interesting because, you know, Elon Musk has been on the record for many years now saying that Tesla doesn't need maps, that maps are a crutch. And, you know, so this is, you know, a U-turn, if you will, if you can forgive a car pun, from this stance that this is not necessary. In China, however, in order for you to offer these sorts of systems, you need to have a partnership with a mapping and navigation company. And it just so happens that the companies that are, you know, able to offer those services are all Chinese. It's very reminiscent of how China sort of controlled the battery, electric vehicle battery market in, you know, the more infant years of the EV industry for China. And it really was successful in helping sort of build up, you know, world dominating companies like CATL. They're looking to try and replicate that sort of, pattern with, you know, companies that play a critical role in these driver assistance systems that may one day be able to support, you know, fully taking the human driver out of the equation.
And what's so interesting is Baidu is itself quite competent in the domain of at least developing autonomous technology. Look, the stock's up 12% or more, on track for its biggest jump since January 2022. Perceived good news. There is some more nuanced view in the markets about what Musk's actually doing here. Craig, listen to this.
Elon Musk saw an opportunity to go in there and say, look, I want to do this, because you've seen the clashes that have been going on between the U.S. and China. He's trying to put a foot in both sides and say, look, I've got this technology. And he had the premium brand in China. And then all of a sudden, the EVs in China started to get less expensive, and Tesla started to lose share, and he had to drop prices. So to me, this is a way to say, I'm going to change up this math for myself. But also, if I can be successful in this, then maybe I get to be the outlier.
That was Sarah Hunt, who's chief market strategist at Alpine Saxon Woods, earlier on Bloomberg Surveillance. We've got a very strong piece on the terminal out now talking about how, well, hold on, a week ago, Musk was supposed to go to India and he bailed and he's gone straight to China. It shows us the power dynamics and Musk's skill in all of this, right, Craig, in navigating geopolitics.
Yeah, I mean, there's been mutual back scratching here between Elon Musk and the CCP for years now. Let's not forget that Tesla was the first, you know, international car company or foreign car company to, you know, be allowed to operate in China without having to agree to a joint venture with a local manufacturer. It was a huge, you know, win for Musk and something that he fought for years. And, you know, the construction of the plant for Tesla in Shanghai was, you know, record time. It was extremely timely in the sense that, you know, Musk was really ramping up the Model 3, trying to bring the Model Y out. And they were able to keep that plant running even during, you know, the pandemic when, you know, other plants in China had a really difficult time, you know, opening back up from the initial shutdowns. And so, you know, China has very much supported Tesla when Tesla needed it most. And, you know, we're seeing U.S. companies pull back a little bit from China, maybe at least de-risk a little. You know, Apple's a good example of doing so, you know, by the way, in India. I think people were looking at a potential investment by Tesla in yes. India as a similar move. And it's clear that Musk doesn't see, you know, urgency to do that.
Bloomberg's Craig Tudell, thank you so much. Terrific reporting. There's another story very close to this one, sticking with autonomous driving. U.S. auto safety regulators are investigating Ford's Blue Cruise driver assistance feature after a pair of fatal crashes involving the technology. The U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's Office of Defect Investigation opened the preliminary evaluation after it received notice of two battery electric Mustang Mach-E SUVs that collided with stationary vehicles. We'll continue to track that one. Stock down 1.6%, Cara.
Notable. Meanwhile, coming up, Ed, look, we've got to turn our attention to another key stock on the move. And Paramount is, we understand, the company weighing ousting its own CEO, at least the board is, ahead of earnings tonight, but also a notable potential purchase of this business. We'll bring you more. This is Bloomberg Technology.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Time for Talking Tech. And first up, the Supreme Court has rejected an appeal by Elon Musk over his so-called Twitter sitter, who oversees social media posts about Tesla. The justices, without comment, refused to hear contentions from the Tesla CEO on the accord that he signed in 2018 that he says now violates his constitutional free speech rights. We'll track that one. Plus, Apple's iPad has been hit by the EU's digital dominance crackdown. The product's been added to a list of big tech products and services hit by the new rules. The move means Apple has 6 months to make sure its tablet ecosystem complies with a raft of preemptive measures under the EU's flagship Digital Markets Act. And the Redstone family and independent film producer David Ellison have both offered concessions to make a possible change in control at Paramount Global more appealing to the company's other investors. The Skydance bid was described by multiple parties as a best and final offer on Sunday. Paramount's board is still undecided about entering a deal with Ellison, given the opposition from other investors. Cara?
Well, the board's got a lot to be considering right now, we understand, Ed, and we want to dig into all of it with Bloomberg's Chris Palmieri, who has been busy throughout the weekend reporting this out, editing it out. And the board, we understand, is also wondering whether it ousts Bob Bakish, the actual current CEO of Paramount, ahead of, well, we know earnings that are already coming out after the bell today, but notably amid this sales process.
Yeah, the situation was described to me yesterday as being very fluid, which is, I think, is an understatement. We're reasonably certain the company will announce earnings this afternoon, but beyond that, yes, they're expected to say goodbye to their CEO, Bob Bakish, replacing him on an interim basis with a management committee. They're still negotiating to deal with Skydance. It would be a change of control of the company, and that was a best and final offer yesterday with David Ellison, the owner of Skydance, upping his sort of contribution in terms of buying Paramount stock at a premium to what it's trading at today, sort of appease shareholders. Redstone's also are apparently making concessions that would allow the non-voting shareholders to weigh in on a deal, which is something that, you know, they don't have to do, but is sort of best practice in securities law these days. So a whole lot going on.
You've outlined the sort of mechanics of the deal. I think just like remind our audience the rationale on the why. Why are we still talking about Paramount and somebody buying it or changing it? What's going on?
Well, the traditional TV business is in trouble. People are leaving for streaming services. Advertising has been in decline, although they'll see a pickup at Paramount this quarter because of the Super Bowl. But and the streaming business, which is the future, is still losing money. Paramount still, although the losses are coming down a bit, are still going to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's a question whether they'll ever stop. And so when your two main businesses like that, the movie business has been unprofitable last year. It's a challenge to get people back to theaters. So pretty much every leg of their business is in some sort of peril, and that's why the stock is down and why they're considering options.
All right, Bloomberg's Chris Palmieri, terrific. Really appreciate having you out down from LA.
SoFi, out with earnings that, well, look strong today, but the forecast is what people are worrying about. The shares falling after the fintech company provided second quarter nuance here, with adjusted net revenue and adjusted EBITDA that perhaps fell short of some consensus estimates out there. We want to dig into that nuance with SoFi CEO Anthony Noto. Thank you for joining us, Anthony. And look, we've got to focus on the fact that your full year guidance was raised. You're feeling positive about the way in which you're steering the company. You say you're at an inflection point, but why the second quarter being below expectations? What can you add to what you're seeing right now?
We had a great first quarter, as we reported, 26% year-over-year growth, and it's in line with the transformation that we talked about, which is our combined tech platform business and our financial services business would grow 50% or more. It grew 54% year-over-year, and that combined with flat revenue for lending, and that was part of the plan. And we had our second consecutive quarter of GAAP positive EPS, in addition to growing our book value on a tangible basis per share by about 16% sequentially. We also guided the full year, as you mentioned, above not just our beat, but also above our prior guidance. So that's a positive overall outlook. We had not given Q2 guidance before. We typically give the full year and then the current quarter that we're in. So at the end of 24, we gave guidance for the full year and Q1, not Q2. The analysts are using their own estimates for that. And because we're taking a conservative view on lending will be down sequentially in Q2, while our tech platform revenue and our financial services revenue will continue to have strong year-over-year growth, but also strong sequential growth and continued profitability as well. So we feel really great about the business and the transformation we've made over the last 6 years.
Yeah.
The fact that we can grow revenue 26% on flat lending revenue is a real testament to the diversity of our business.
I hate to ask them, but you can't feel great about the share reaction.
You know, any given day, it's hard to predict what's going to happen with the shares. But what I can say is the business is doing incredibly well. The strategy is working. We're really happy about the trend. We are taking a conservative view on lending, but that's prudent given how uncertain the environment is. If the environment becomes more stable, we'll be more aggressive on lending. But right now, there's no need to, and the environment remains as uncertain as it has for the last 6 months on rates.
Mr. Noto, good morning. It's Ed in San Francisco. A lot of the questions I got from our audience for you were about the capital you raised and your strategy going forward. There was convertible in 1Q. A lot of interest in that. I actually am not clear why, but the people want to know. So that's the question.
Yeah, I think people misunderstand the share count. First, we did two things in Q1. First, we issued a convertible note at 1.25% interest. That allowed us to redeem a preferred security that we were paying 12.5% interest on. So that is going to provide an interest savings for us. And we've already noticed all of the holders of that preferred instrument. And so that's being redeemed sooner than expected. We also bought back an existing convert that was trading well below its face value. And that was accretive to book value, and it was basically neutral on tangible book value per share. So there's some perception that it was dilutive. It's not dilutive on a tangible book value per share. I think there's just a misunderstanding on what the total ending share count will be in the future.
My colleague at Bloomberg Intelligence, Herman Chan, has a very clear thesis for you guys. You have a brilliant app, strong user interface, one-stop shop, and you're targeting young professionals. That's what they think. But the story really is this higher interest rates for longer environment narrative. How does that thesis work in that rate environment, Anthony?
Yeah, well, first of all, your colleague said it very well, and so we should consider having them being one of our spokespeople. But what I'd say is higher for longer is going to create challenges for financial institutions. We are very well capitalized. We have a 17.1% risk-based capital ratio, so we have ample cushion or capital ratio relative to where we have to operate from a regulatory standpoint, and we have plenty of liquidity. That said, as we saw today, another regional bank was really challenged. We're also benefiting from really strong deposit growth. We had a record growth in deposits, $3 billion of new deposits, and 90% of our deposits are from direct deposit customers, which means we're their primary account, and it's very, very sticky. But a higher for longer will put stress on other people's balance sheets if they're not hedging appropriately the way we do. We hedge our loans once we grant them, so we don't have that interest rate exposure. We can also match what we're giving as an APY to our SoFi Money members against the loans that we're offering and the rates that they have to maintain a very high NIM, and we've been able to do that consistently. In addition to that, we also have the tech platform business, which is not tied to interest rates. And then in the financial services business, we have the Invest platform that's growing very nicely, good AUM growth, good member growth, and another source of diversified revenue for us.
We're a technology show, and we want to go into the specifics of your technology, Anthony, but I want to bring our audience that macro flavor that you so brilliantly give, because why are you more cautious on the U.S. economy? Why are you seeing 5% excess of unemployment? Why are you seeing these interest rate cuts that you've now basically halved in your expectations for 2024?
Yeah, our balance sheet has grown quite meaningfully. It's about a $30 billion balance sheet now. So as we came into 2024, we had a choice. Could we come up with our own expectations for 2024? Could we use consensus expectation? Let's just take a planning stance that's really conservative. And the planning stance that we took then was that there would only be 4 rate cuts. The market was factoring in 6 rate cuts at the time. We also took a planning stance on unemployment that would be more than 5%. The market was well below that. And we also took a stance on GDP contraction that was modest. Well, here we sit today, 3 months later, and the market's only factoring in 1 to 2 rate cuts. So I'm really thankful we took a conservative stance going into the year, and I'm really thankful we still have a conservative stance. I couldn't feel better about the underlying trends of our strategy and execution of our business, but I don't think we're in an environment where anyone has a really strong high conviction level on where rates will be. There's still a debate whether there'll be any rate cuts whatsoever. So we just can't put the business at risk, hoping that we can figure it out. So we're going to a conservative point of view.
But we're short of time, Anthony. You're moving away from this kind of trademark student loans and refi business. Why?
Well, the strategy when I came in 2018 was to create a one-stop shop for all your financial services needs. There was no one providing all the products that you need for the big moments in your life and all the days in between. So we offer home loans, student loans, personal loans, in-school loans, checking and savings called SoFi Money, investing, insurance, small, medium business loan, lead generation, in addition to the tech platform business. So the strategy was always about building a one-stop shop for all your financial services needs. And that's actually resulted in a diversified business that allows us to make choices on what we grow versus what we take a conservative view on.
SoFi CEO Anthony Noto, great to catch up. Great to have you back on the program. Thank you. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. Ed Ludlow in San Francisco.
I'm Caroline Hyde in New York. Let's get a bit of breaking news that was just occurring regarding WeWork. We understand it has managed to cut a bankruptcy exit deal that actually leaves out the founder, Adam Neumann. Now, we understand WeWork, of course, has got an all-important meeting today, April 29th. They're cutting an exit deal, leaves out Adam Neumann. Neumann himself is objecting, saying the deal wrongly hides a sale plan. And Neumann has offered to buy WeWork, but it was rejected in favor of a creditor deal. Now, remember, there's plenty of analysis that has gone into the bankruptcy of WeWork more broadly, and indeed the fact that they've basically got a $4 billion in secured debt that is a key issue, limiting issue here more broadly. But it looks as though a deal has been cut, but Adam Neumann is not involved. Let's just get a broader market check for you at the moment because, well, markets have been tentatively higher. NASDAQ 100 just still clinging on to gains of some 27 points. All important week, the Fed, we got jobs data at the end of the week. The dollar still lower versus the Japanese yen. That was a big market move from a macro perspective, is maybe we see some BOJ intervention that has so far remained silent from Japan, and it is indeed some muted amid a holiday trading session. But I'm looking at Bitcoin just off by a percentage point as the US dollar remains higher versus Bitcoin. Let's have a little look at what's happening on individual names. I want to shine like what happened in Europe because we've just finished up trading in Europe and Atos up 18%. Now, this is another kind of beleaguered company, but this one is a French government potentially stepping in with a bid for the IT company's most strategically important businesses. That's after it's been forced to raise the amount of cash it needs to avoid insolvency itself. It's up more than 18%. SES, I shine a light on what's happening with this particular, well, overall company, the two firms we could see when it comes to all important views on the coming together of SES and Intelsat. This is as we once again think about a merger in these satellite businesses. The deal failed in previous attempts to combine, but now we see that potentially they could be seeing an SES and Intelsat revival of discussions. We're down some 10% in that publicly traded part of the business. Remember, Intelsat is private. MicroStrategy up more than a percentage point. Well, he's doing all right, old Michael Saylor, on the fact that he's been selling some shares in the business after it's done particularly well amid being sort of a proxy for Bitcoin. But 1,296, their earnings come after the bell. But we want to talk more about crypto, and we want to talk more about what's happening in Hong Kong, because it's set to list a batch of cryptocurrency ETFs. And some of China's top asset managers are in final leg of preparations for a spot Bitcoin and ETH ETF to begin trading tomorrow. Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld joins us for more. You're probably pretty bored about spot ETFs. But what's interesting with Hong Kong is it looks as though we're also seeing Australia analyze the options. This is a theme since the US got on board.
It's definitely a theme, this sort of expanding access to spot Bitcoin ETFs. And it's interesting, you take a look at Hong Kong, sort of following the US blueprint in that we have a fee war breaking out even before the funds have actually launched. They're due to launch on April 30th tomorrow. But we're talking about a trio of issuers here. We have China AMC, then we have Harvest and Vocera. So you had China AMC and Harvest announce their fees. And just in the past few days, Vocera actually came out and waived their fee. They were their eventual fee is going to be 60 basis points. They're waiving that for the first 4 months or so. You compare that to Harvest. They're also going ahead with a fee waiver, which is also very popular in the U.S. After 6 months, they're going to charge 0.3%. So that's your low watermark there. And then China AMC, it's on the high side. It's charging 99 basis points. Oh. So a bit expensive compared to its trio, its sort of peers there. But we'll have to see. What we saw in the U.S. market was, even though you had those fees cut into the launch, after the launch too, you had a lot of reductions as well.
On this program, Bloomberg Technology, we love covering cities around the world. Hong Kong is clearly considering this important, but in actuality, it's a small market, you know. Give us the numbers.
It is a small market. That is an important perspective to get in there. When you take a look at Hong Kong's total ETF market, the total AUM is about $47 billion. Just for some context, you take a look at the suite of U.S. spot Bitcoin ETFs. They're already above that when you put together those dozen or so funds. So on the world scale, we're talking about a very small market here. When you think about the impact to Bitcoin, of course, probably not too meaningful from an inflows perspective, but when it comes to sentiment, which is what powers Bitcoin, it could be meaningful.
Boomer's Katie Greifeld, we love having you on this show with your knowledge of spot Bitcoin ETF around the world. Thank you very much. Let's go from crypto back to entertainment with Paramount's board considering removing CEO Bob Bakish. I want to get the take and the analysis of Bloomberg Intelligence's Geeta Ranganathan. And I'm looking at the stock, right? We're up almost 5%. I don't know if that's because of the news or reports that Bakish might be going or that the deal as it is moving along. What do you think the catalyst is, Geeta?
I think, Ed, the catalyst for the movement this morning is really just based on the sweetening of the Ellison deal. So two things happening here. One is that David Ellison, who owns Skydance Media, is now proposing to buy a block of shares at a premium, kind of making it more palatable for investors. And I think, finally, Sherry Redstone is the one who kind of calls all the shots at Paramount. She's finally open for what is this majority of a minority vote. So she is letting the non-voting shareholders have a say in whether this transaction should go through. And that is really critical because there has been so much backlash against the Skydance deal because most of these shareholders, the non-voting shareholders, have basically said that it's going to dilute them and it really only benefits, you know, the Skydance and, of course, Sherry Redstone.
One of those key investors from a non-voting perspective have been Ariel Investments, and John Rogers and Melody Hobson had been putting out letters saying, look, we are worried about the way in which this is being executed, the premium and then the merge of what's happening with Skydance. But also they were troubled by the looming departures of four Paramount board members. Is all of this looking a little bit murky from a governance perspective, if you're also seeing a board and potentially getting rid of the CEO and putting executives in charge while this transition sort of occurs?
Yeah, I mean, it's highly, highly unusual, Caroline. We've never seen something quite like this before in the media landscape. So you have those four, you know, board members who kind of suddenly left. And then now you have Bob Bakish, who has been the CEO of this company for quite a while. I mean, ever since Viacom and CBS were merged, he's kind of taken a charge. And he's kind of, I think, done a fairly good job, although some people would say that, you know, getting into the streaming business was not a good idea to begin with. And you know, that's because, yes, they have 70 million subscribers. They've had some successes, but they've also lost a ton of money. They've lost about $5 billion. And a lot of people seem to think that, you know, that's because of kind of this misstep or was a misstep by Bob Bakish. So, yes, there's a lot of confusion right now. Basically, it definitely, getting rid of Bob Bakish definitely challenges the status quo. But I think what Sherry Redstone is hoping to achieve is then get, you know, Bob Bakish has been very vocal against the deal with Skydance. So I think she's really kind of trying to hasten the process towards a deal with Skydance here.
Wow, it looks as though it is evolving very quickly on the day, and I'm sure we'll be looking for your expertise again. Bloomberg Intelligence Analyst Geeta Ranganathan, we thank you so much on all things Paramount. Meanwhile, coming up, we're going to take a look at a new kind of college. Caught the eye, a founders fund. More on that in our Venture Spotlight. This is Bloomberg Technology.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, Done.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Campus.edu is an online alternative to traditional community colleges that's trying to tackle all kinds of problems, one of them being student loan debt in the United States. And it caught the attention of Founders Fund, which just led a new $23 million extension round in the platform. Disclaimer, Bloomberg Beta, the venture capital arm of Bloomberg LP, is also an investor in Campus.edu. Here to discuss is Founders Fund partner Trey Stevens, who led the round, and Campus.edu founder and chancellor Tade Oyerinde. Tade, I'm going to start with you. I actually have been through the mechanics of how this works. Okay. You know, you sign up, you may be eligible for federal funding grants, but you basically pay $7,000 to $7,500 for the course. And you're also bringing an employment opportunity for very talented professors, yep. Which raises the question, why do you need $23 million
more? Yeah, thanks for having me. Look, I think if you look at the faculty at these elite universities, Princeton, UCLA, and Stanford, a lot of them are looking for gig work. And so what we do at campus is we allow them to teach. We bring access to people who had never had access to this quality of education before. And then, yes, as you pointed out, the federal government does actually pay for a lot of the tuition with the grants.
One of the learnings from researching and reading into this is that some of our brightest academics and teachers are pretty poorly paid in this country. Trey, I know you. I know where you invest thematically, specific founders that you back. This one's really interesting. Why are you focused on education? But this is a very specific case study in education.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that we are focused on education. We don't do a whole lot at all in EdTech.
That's
actually
what I mean.
At Founders Fund. Yeah.
Yeah,
Peter is kind of known as having this anti-higher education perspective, which led to the Thiel Fellowship, which is the fellowship that he offers to students to drop out of college and pursue something entrepreneurial. And so I think that what this really kind of hit that I haven't seen a lot in EdTech is this idea that we don't need to have a bunch of students going into massive debt. The average student in the United States that's going into higher ed has debt over $20,000. I had debt over $100,000 coming out of college, and there's just no reason for this. And so I think what Tade and the team at campus is doing is really exciting because it's a way of bridging that out to make it possible for kids that want to go to school after they finish high school and do that at much lower costs and exit their college experience without any debt.
Tade, therefore, we go back to the need of funds. You've got clear demand coming from students. You've got clear supply coming from the professors. There's perhaps a bit of a bottleneck when it comes to the coaches that you want to be mentoring and stimulating and advising. But where will the funds be put to work? Is this about market share capture right now?
Yeah, look, Caroline, the opportunity is just so big. If you look at student loans in this country, it's about to pass $2 trillion. So to actually solve this and create a world-class quality education and scale that up to lots of people, it's going to require lots of investment. And we give students a lot of wraparound support that most community colleges just can't afford to offer. So every student gets a laptop. You know, about a third of our students, we do an internet speed test. If your internet's too slow, we'll actually get you internet at home. We pair them with success coaches who play the role like my mother played for me when I was in college, like making sure I'm showing up for class on time and getting my assignments in. And that's a key part of like what a lot of young people are going to need to be successful today. So I'm very grateful for Trey and, you know, the team at Founders Fund, because this is a big mission, but it's going to require funding.
Yeah, Trey, why did you take the call or the email or the introduction in whatever way? If you're not that focused on education, as you've clearly articulated, why this one when there are some other online competitors out there?
Yeah, the important thing for us, as it is with all companies, is that we are founder-based, first and foremost. So less than investing in categories or, you know, specific types of companies, we're really interested in investing in the top founders that are doing the most interesting things, the most novel concepts. And so when I originally met Tade, you know, not generally being interested in EdTech, I was blown away by his vision for what the company was going to be doing, and ultimately just decided to bring other people from the fund in front of him, saying like, this guy is different than the other founders that we've seen in the ed tech space. We should really be open to learning from him and getting excited about the thing that he has so much passion for.
Okay, so Tade, you dropped a reference to the sort of gig economy earlier in the conversation. So I'm thinking Uber, or, you know, there are other gig economy platforms out there that do food delivery, et cetera. How's that business going to play out in practice? You know, Trey invests in founders. He backs those founders. He's also an investor who needs to see a return in the future.
Yeah. So look, the way it works with campus, if you're a professor at Princeton, UCLA, Morehouse, you have your on-campus job. It has an office. You love it. You get to meet with students. But oftentimes you're an adjunct professor. I used to think adjuncts meant like Michelle Obama teaches at Georgetown for fun to give
visiting
back.
Or guest or whatever.
That's really rare. The most adjuncts are actually recent grad school graduates. They're earning 40 to 45 grand a year. And so what we do is you can actually teach in addition to your on-campus job on campus, campus.edu, and we pay about double the national average wage. So it's about $8,000 per class. So just simplicity of math, you know, four academic quarters a year. If you teach three classes a quarter with us, you're making an additional $96,000 in annual income, and you're doing what you're great at and what you love doing, teaching these students who are super ambitious, like super talented.
I want to focus on another founder you back when it comes to Neuralink. Elon Musk today, he led the show with the fact that in his other company, Tesla, he is deepening ties with China. He's bringing his driver assistance program over there to, of course, one of the key markets for him. But how do you sit at the moment with founders, with just U.S. more broadly, seeing still some relationship with China at the time that also you're seeing some distancing?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely always a good reason to have nuance. There's a lot of different, you know, stakes that need to be taken into consideration when you look at interacting with the Chinese market versus interacting with the Chinese government versus interacting with government control over things that are impacting U.S. consumers. And so I think obviously diplomacy is critical in all these scenarios. Elon is doing what Elon needs to do for the companies that he has operating in country there.
What about, well, TikTok being the other key piece of news when it comes to how that affects the consumer, a relationship of using what is a Chinese-held business here in the United States, a ban or divest. What did you make of that move? How worried are you about the use of TikTok for at least another 9 months?
I mean, I'm very concerned. I've been very public in expressing my concerns around the use of TikTok domestically. You know, during the Cold War, we never would have allowed for a Russian company to buy the New York Times. I think having some sense for adversary control of key pathways for information into our populace is super critical. And TikTok has demonstrated time and time again that they are not willing to be transparent. They're not willing to share with us the important information that we would need to know to have a level of confidence in their ability to support those technologies being deployed in the United States.
We've got to think about the AI, all-encompassing narrative here, Ed, a little bit. When we were talking about Elon and Tesla, you referenced Baidu, of course, big stakes in AI there. We've also got TikTok owned by ByteDance. That China's got its own interest in all of this at the moment, Ed.
For me, that's the story, right? That all the stories we talk about, be it Tesla in China, TikTok, China is working on these technologies itself, you know, particularly in the context of generative AI or building large language models. We spent 12 months saying, well, China's also doing this. The question for someone like you and your industry is, how do you get the balance right between being collaborative and also putting US interests first? That's basically what I think it comes down to for you.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the CCP is very different than the Chinese people or the Chinese market. These things are not always intrinsically connected. I think that the thing that we're constantly trying to balance, not only inside of our portfolio, but also with what we're doing at Anduril, which is a portfolio company of Founders Fund that I started back in 2017, is to really figure out where we need to not only develop, but also sustain strategic advantage so that we are able to set the rules of engagement for how those technologies are actually used in the field. And the moment we no longer have control of a technology, that's when we lose control of the ability to regulate and keep those technologies inside the bounds of law.
I'm glad you took us to Anduril and Defense Tech. There have been several column inches written about you and your place and leadership in investing in defense technology. What I want to ask you is if you're seeing signs that the US government, the top level of government, is now sort of hand in hand with Silicon Valley. Like, you guys do it really well, so go and do it.
I guess the working with the government's really hard. I don't know how else to say that. Before I joined Founders Fund 10 years ago, I was doing sales at Palantir, where I spent the prior 6 years of my career. And no matter what we tried, it was like every single iteration of our sales strategy was just not working, going too slow, running into roadblocks. Eventually, we figured out a model that worked. Same could be said for SpaceX. It took them years and years and years to figure out how to do this. And the reality is like going into this industry blind, like, two 19-year-olds working in a garage, very different than starting a software as a service company.
As Dr. Carr put it to me a few weeks ago, end the PowerPoint, no more PowerPoints. Founder Fund, Trey Stevens, great to have you back on the show. Caro.
It really was a great discussion. And look, that does it for this whirlwind edition of Bloomberg Technology.
Yeah, there is so much in the news flow. It's a huge earnings week. Great guests on the show. Recap on the podcast, Apple, Spotify, iHeart, and the Bloomberg platforms. From San Francisco and New York, this is Bloomberg Technology.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.